We're talking with Dr. Alan Bodkin about after-death communication, induced ADCs, a book by that title, has some fascinating case studies. And when we come back, a couple more questions from me, and we'll go to the phone lines as well, right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Alan, before the break, you were about to tell me who is not suitable for this kind of treatment or therapy. Yeah. I would imagine it has to be somebody who's lucid, not somebody who's just completely out of it.
Well, absolutely. Could I mention just a couple points of business first before
I
forget? My primary website is, I mentioned before, induced-adc.com. There was also healingafterthewar.org. Please visit that. There are some filmmakers involved in doing some filming on IADC. And so please take a look at that. And there's some videos on healingafterthewar.org. And I should clarify, just to make clear, that my first book came out in 2005, and it was entitled Induced After-Death Communication, A New Therapy for Healing Grief and Trauma. Well, the book was updated recently, and the new title is Induced After-Death Communication, A Miraculous Therapy for Grief and Loss. So I assume people would want to make sure they get the newest version. So
yes.
Thank you.
Yes, absolutely.
The screening process. Out of people who call me, I probably accept 85% of people who call me, so the screening process is not exclusionary. But there are a few reasons why I would not work with somebody. Yeah, and yes, they first have to be lucid, and they can't be psychotic and so on, because this kind of therapy might only make them worse. But one important point has to do with the timing. If the death is within 6 months, it may be too early for this procedure. And the reason is the early stage of grief is generally characterized by shock and disbelief and emotional numbing. And that emotional numbing is adaptive. People have to make funeral arrangements, clean out bedrooms, and so on. You know, I would never want to take that away from people. And for IADC to work, they need to be able and willing to fully go after their sadness. And it takes some time for the all of that sadness to emerge.
And so, on the flip side of it, is there such a thing as it's been too long since the...
No. In fact, my record is I worked with an elderly man whose loss was 74 years in the past. And it worked just fine.
And he was still grieving.
A part of him still had some unresolved grief, yes.
Tell me a little bit about your network. I don't know if it's your network, but a network exists. People who've been trained by you, you mentioned there's 200 names on your website of professionals who do this kind of stuff. So basically, they're all over the country, and somebody could check the list and look for one that's closest to them.
Actually, they're all over the world at this point. Most are in the United States, but there are a large number of IADC therapists in Germany. IADC is very big there. As a matter of fact, there is an Alan Bodkin Institute there in Saarbrücken, Germany, that's devoted to IADC training and research and so on. I even have somebody in South America, Korea, not many in Canada yet, not many in the UK yet, but it's starting to grow in France. It's starting to grow rapidly in Italy as well. As a matter of fact, the book, my book was translated and published in Germany in some time ago, and recently the Italian version came out.
Is it expensive?
No, it's cheap. It's cheap and it's an easy read. On Amazon, it might be $14, $13.
I'm talking about the treatment itself. I guess it varies from person to person.
Different therapists charge different amounts.
Tell me this. Have you had any cases where people have had multiple losses that they have to deal with so that they have to come back and they can't deal with them in one treatment or two treatments?
Absolutely.
And like somebody who's had lost their whole family, do they have to deal with each family member individually, kind of a thing?
Yes. Generally, you have to do it individually. And when I was at the VA, I worked with guys who had many losses. I mean, some would have maybe 15 or 20 losses. That's doable. You just have to do one at a time. And the other thing is about the screening process is you always need to be working on the most distressing issue first. And so if somebody calls and wants to work on the death of grandmother, and when I'm screening them, but they were in a serious car accident that traumatized them, and if the car accident is more distressing, we need to do that first, because the eye movement or bilateral stimulation, what it does is it tends to bring up the most distressing memory first, not necessarily the one you want to you choose to work on.
I was asking about people with multiple losses. You mentioned about soldiers. There are cases that you mentioned in the book where a soldier, a former combat veteran or something, who's lost a bunch of comrades, goes into this experience and he sees a bunch of those guys all at once, right?
Oh, yeah. That was probably the most dramatic group ADC experience I've ever witnessed. A guy had left Vietnam. He was discharged, was back home, and he found out that his best friend was killed, but not only his best friend, almost the entire rest of the company was killed, like 80 or 90 guys. And you only work on one at a time, and you always work on the most distressing loss first. So we were working on the death of his best friend, and in the ADC, his friend was standing there right in front of him talking to him, but behind his friend were all the rest of the guys in the company who had died. He said it was strange. He said it looked like they were sitting on bleachers at a football game. And he could go down each row and look at every face individually. And he said, oh, yeah, that was Billy Bob. I remember him. That was Joe. Yeah, that's Joe. Oh, there's George. I haven't thought about him in 20 years. And oh, I remember that guy. I don't think I ever knew his name. And went through the whole thing. And they were all waving at him, too.
We got a caller, Jeff, in Culver City. Hi, Jeff. What's on your mind?
Mr. Blackin, can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Yep. Yeah, hi, George, Mr. Blackin. Yeah, just tonight while listening to you guys, you know, I briefly drifted off to sleep for no more than 10 minutes. You know, it's been a long day. But during that 10 minutes, I seem to have been taken back to my former job. The last time I worked there was in 1999, and I dreamed that I was talking to a coworker who worked there about some brand new boots he had just bought. Upon awaking and still listening, you know, to Coast to Coast, I was curious to know if the old guy was dead or alive, you know, since I haven't heard from him or seen him since 1999. I called another former coworker to ask about the guy, and he told me that he died sometime in 2011. You know, this communication with the dead is real if you can do it. And it seems that the best way, Mr. Botkin, and the only way to do this is through dreams. Would you agree? And I'll take your answer off there.
Thanks, Jeff.
Well, spontaneous ADCs, most often in my experience, have occurred when people are asleep. Now, because they're experiences that happen when we're asleep, people tend to call them dreams. But there's a very different quality between a dream and in an ADC that happens during sleep. And so even though that is the most common of spontaneous ADCs, that doesn't always have to happen that way. And it's, of course, when we do IADC and we induce the experience, it's also very much not like a dream. It has a clarity and an emotional impact that dreams generally don't have,
And a coherence to the narrative, I would guess. Because if it happens when they're asleep, I can see the people very easily concluding it must be a dream or dismissing it in that way.
Well, you know, a lot of people will say, well, I had this dream of my deceased husband, but boy, it was it didn't seem like a regular dream to me. But, you know, people still call them dreams, but they are very different.
I think it's we sort of touched on this in the beginning of the program, how universal it is. I don't know if it's universal, but how common it is for people to see loved ones after they're gone. I mean, seeing them before you know they're gone. You know, there's mom waving to you, and then you find out an hour later that mom died this morning. That kind of thing happens a lot.
Those experiences are rather common, and I have talked to many people who have reported those kinds of experiences, yes. And it's not a matter of hit and miss, like they're right 60% of the time. They seem to be right all of the time.
How interested is your profession in this? I mean, are you invited to speak about it? Do the journals ask you to write papers? You mentioned there's a couple of hundred who've been trained, which is encouraging. But, I mean, there are thousands of people who could be trained, who could be helping patients, right. 10 times, 100 times as many patients.
Well, that is our goal, is to train more and more people, because then more and more people get to benefit from this therapy. So, you know, we're doing the best we can to get this information out there. And I thank you, George, for helping us do that.
But are you invited to speak about it? I bet there's still some hands-off kind of a feeling.
You know, in the scientific community, people aren't like those diehard skeptics who already have their mind made up. As a matter of fact, one of my colleagues is going to speak at a major EMDR conference sometime in September. And those are all professional people, and they are interested in hearing what this IADC is all about. I get a lot of letters, anonymous. Well, they ask that I keep it confidential, but I get letters from university professors who write me and say they admire my courage and keep going and congratulations and so on. So, you know, actually I'm getting pretty good support from mainstream people.
Well, the EMDR, and that's an eye movement procedure that is widely accepted. I mean,
EMDR is now considered a mainstream psychotherapeutic method all over the world. There have been many, many scientific studies, control group design studies, and so on EMDR, almost all with very positive results that show that EMDR is in fact extremely an effective therapy. And I think there's something like maybe 50 or 60,000 EMDR therapists all over the world at this point.
I thought one of the interesting things in the book was you compare this approach to the previous sort of paradigm, and that paradigm of like where you have to have the patient relive this experience, go through the trauma all over again, and then sort of sever it. And in this case, the people who come out of this experience sort of carry the memory with them, and it's an important difference and an important part of how they recover.
Absolutely. Without the ADC at the end, this high-powered processing of the sadness completely changes the sadness, and along with the anger and the guilt and so on. The old methods of exposure therapy, where the idea is just bringing up the trauma, is somehow supposed to help people. It really doesn't. It really, at least in the short run, makes people feel a lot worse. So it's all about bringing up the trauma, but then doing something with it once it's brought up. And that's where this eye movement, EMDR, and IADC as a variation do such a great job. It actually changes the way the memory is represented in the brain.
I guess it would be fair to say that there's a much broader group of people who could benefit from this than people might expect, because, as you said, so many of us deal with grief by putting it in a box and just not thinking about it anymore.
Right.
And you lock it away and you cope. You learn to cope. But there might be millions of people for whom that grief is manifesting itself in their lives in different destructive, non-productive ways. That can
Absolutely.
Benefit from this.
Absolutely. You know, people generally adopt a number of strategies to help them to distract themselves from that pain they're carrying. Some people become workaholics. Some people become alcoholics. Some people use drugs and so on and so forth. But and some people just carry around a whole lot of rage and anger. And oftentimes that rage and anger is all about covering up their deep pain.
Tell me this. Was the VA okay with you doing this? Did you have to tell your superiors, hey, what I'm doing here? It seems to be working. It's a little unconventional. Or did you not tell them?
Well, it's kind of a complicated story. We didn't go around advertising it. Let me put it that way. We weren't sure how administration would respond to it. And at the time, we saw ourselves as basically doing EMDR with some variation to it. We described ourselves as EMDR therapists, which is a mainstream, scientifically, validated approach. I do remember I had a journal article that came out in the year 2000. That was my first publication. And the chief of psychiatry at the hospital got his hands on it and came and talked to the director of the PTSD unit and said, hey, what's this all about? What's this Dr. Botkin up to? And the director of the PTSD unit said, listen, leave him alone, because whatever he's doing, the vets are knocking the door down to get in, and there's a line going around the block, essentially. There was a waiting list of about 10 to 12 months just to even get into my program. So the message was, don't bother him. He's good for the hospital numbers and the people with the green eye shades and all that stuff.
So really the word spread, word of mouth kind of spread among the soldiers.
Yes. Yes. And it was a lot of word of mouth, and yeah, you can trust this Dr. Botkin guy, and he's got things that work, and so on. I had my own program at the VA called the Intensive Trauma Program, where I would take a cohort of five vets, and again, this is the inpatient unit, and I would have them for a month, and we essentially did trauma work all day long.
I'm wondering if there's anybody at VA who's still doing it. I mean, there's still people doing EMDR stuff, eye movement treatment. Could you, is there any way that you can stumble into this? I guess you stumbled into it. Is there any way anybody's going to stumble into it on their own again? Or do you have secret colleagues who are still doing it back there? I hope so.
Well, I mean, there are people in the VA and at other hospitals and hospices and so on who use IADC on a regular basis and are getting great results.
I wonder if you've been, I asked about the interest level among your professional colleagues. What about interest from religious folks? I know you would, as a scientist, you'd want to have some sort of a hands-off contact with that, but I would think that there would be a lot of interest at that level as well.
There is. There are people at both extremes. I won't use his name, but I know a man who is a Catholic bishop and a very astute biblical scholar, and he read my stuff, and I said, well, what do you think? And he says, well, it's absolutely consistent with what the Bible's been teaching for a couple thousand years. And then I said, well, what about, and there are some groups that are more fundamentalist, who have said this is the work of the devil and so on, and I asked the bishop about that. He said, oh, those are the people that interpret the Bible literally.
Well, I tell you what, we need to take a short break. We'll come back and go back to the phone lines with my guest, Dr. Alan Botkin, here to talk about induced after-death communication. We're talking with Dr. Alan Botkin about this amazing technique he's developed, induced after-death communication, IADC. He makes the comparison in his book by that title to Galileo, who in 1609 I was trying to convince scientists that Copernicus was right about the nature of the solar system, and he developed a telescope, and scientists of the time didn't even want to look through it because they didn't want their sort of their worldview, their paradigm destroyed. They didn't even want to take a look and risk being wrong. And I think there's a comparison. It's a valid comparison to what's going on here now. If those professionals who don't even want to take a look at this, despite some pretty amazing results. A couple more cases we're going to get into on the other side here in our final segment with Dr. Bodkin. Stick around. Dr. Bodkin, at the beginning of the program, I mentioned how in the foreword to your book, Dr. Raymond Moody mentions that humans have been reporting these kinds of experiences for a long time. The ancient Greeks used to go down into the ground, I guess. Sort of a sensory deprivation kind of an environment. Is that necessary for this to happen, or is that an added benefit?
Well, it's not necessary. Of course, IADC works without sensory deprivation, but it is clear that Raymond Moody was the first to discover, not me, the first to discover a technique which makes these ADC experiences more likely. And his procedure, which he calls psychomantium, involves spending time with the person during most of the day, walking through the woods, talking about their deceased loved one, and so on. And then after that, they are put in a darkened room with offset light. And he reports that as many as 50% of his people have ADCs under those conditions.
You know, of course, one component of near-death experience reports is out-of-body experience. Is there anything like that with your experience? I mean, with the people who are coming back and telling the story, they're not flying around outside their bodies, are they?
No. They sense many times being where their deceased loved one is. Like, you know, they're there in the beautiful field. The case of Gary, he was in a beautiful field. He felt like he was there with his daughter, and his daughter looked at him. But it doesn't come up where people feel like they're floating around the room or go outside the building or anything like that.
There's a case in the book. I'll try to help you remember it. It's Mimi, and the title of it is given, "That Was Kind of Creepy." It's where Mimi experienced a number of rather profound IADCs, which appeared to resolve her grief. She then chose to work on the loss of her dog, whom she'd loved dearly. And near the end of this IADC with her dog, a neighbor who had recently died unexpectedly just popped in out of nowhere. Do you remember this one?
Yes. Is that the
I guess she and the deceased neighbor had been good friends, but he was looking younger and healthier. I'm not sure she even knew he had died.
Yeah. If I remember, either that or I'm confusing it with another case, somebody popped into somebody's ADC and asked that my patient
do something.
Do something. Go tell his family and And this person was not in a brightly lit, beautiful place like most people are. And there does seem to be something in ADCs that comes up every now and then. It's fairly rare, though, that somebody is not in. It's not a hellish place with pitchforks and fires and that kind of thing. But they're in a somewhat darker, spiritually speaking, place. And this is very consistent with what Raymond Moody reported in one of his books. He called it the realm of bewildered spirits. It's like people who haven't completely moved on to the better, more beautiful place. And these are generally people who did bad things in life.
That interesting raises some interesting questions too. Do you have people whose guilt is not related necessarily to the loss of a loved one, but because they've done really, really bad things themselves?
Absolutely. Of course, when I was at the VA, I worked with many people who purposely killed, obviously, enemy soldiers. And at the time, they were full of rage and anger and felt exhilarated and felt good about what they had done. And their buddies said, way to go, and so on and so forth. But maybe years later, that memory would start to creep back without the anger, and the guys would sometimes remember the frightened look on the face of the enemy soldier before they killed him and so on, and then started feeling much later in life a great amount of both sadness and guilt for what they had done. And IADC works just as well with in these cases as it does if you were doing an ADC with your own mother. And what you have to be able to do is connect with the humanity of the person you killed. In other words, you need to be able to allow yourself to grieve for your victim. In other words, feel the sadness and so on. And in those cases that I worked with in the VA and all of them, the enemy soldier appeared in the ADC and forgave my patient.
Never had one where it's you've got a patient who turns out to be truly evil, done something really bad, not just a soldier in war, but something did something bad, and they get a message from the other side that's pretty harsh.
I've never had that happen that I can remember.
It's sort of like, it sort of like works like confession for some faiths, Catholics and others, absolution of some sort. You tell this, you work it out, and you feel better.
Yeah, and you work it out with that person. And in all cases so far, you know, forgiveness has been forthcoming. But again, it's not an easy out. It's not an easy out for your guilt, because you have to fully grieve for that victim, for that person you killed. And sometimes they weren't enemy soldiers. I worked with a guy who killed a whole family in a car crash, and it was his fault.
Oh. And he was okay after this? Tell me that story.
Okay. This was a long time ago, one of my first cases, and I don't remember it really well, but I can tell you that, a whole family was killed, a mother and a father and two daughters or something like that. And he felt horrendous sadness and guilt for what he had done. And I think when he was talking about the trauma in session with me, he literally fell out of his chair sobbing. And but anyways, he addressed his sadness, and we pulled it up and processed it. And in the ADC, the family came to him and forgave him. And in the ADC, he could clearly see what everybody looked like, their facial features and so on. And he had never seen pictures of them. But his sister had kept an article about the accident, and she had it in her attic or somewhere in a closet somewhere. And there was a picture of the family that was killed. But he could never look at that. But after he had the ADC, he went and looked at the picture, and it was the same people.
Oh. Back to this Mimi case that I mentioned. What had happened was this deceased neighbor appeared to her. She's trying to communicate or resolve things with her dog that had died, and a neighbor appears, and he tells her he has a job for her. He hints that he has a job. And then in a second experience, I guess, he told her that he wanted her to help other deceased spirits who seemed to be in a darker place, not dark in terms of light, but in a spiritual way. And she was kind of creeped out by it.
Yeah, and she was. And when she told me what he had said, and she said she didn't want to do it, it's too creepy, I said, well, you need to tell him that.
And did she?
And she did. And he left her alone.
Wow, that's pretty strange. You ever have you had many cases like that where they give them something specific to do?
No. This case was particularly unusual in that way. I mean, sometimes people get like friendly advice from like a mother or deceased father. You know, you need to be doing this or doing that.
Like stop smoking and start exercising and eating right?
Yeah. Or, get like the case we mentioned before, forgive your wife and get back together with her, you know, that kind of stuff.
You had a case, George's case, you call it. George and his younger brother had entered a life of drugs and crime many years before he came to see you. In the course of their dealings, they developed some enemies who vowed revenge on him. George goes home or go to his brother's apartment, found his brother severely beaten and unconscious, and medical personnel arrived. They announce him dead. So in addition to feeling a tremendous loss, he believed he was responsible for his brother's death. Do you remember this one?
Yes. I know he had an ADC with his brother, and his brother, I think, said something like, you know, don't blame yourself. I take full responsibility for my actions, something like that.
Yeah, that's, yeah. It's like whoever it is over there, they sort of let you off the hook.
Yeah. And at the same time, we, the living people, have this tendency to pile a whole bunch of irrational guilt upon ourselves. It's our fault that things happen and so on. And that's kind of an illusion that we live under, that we have control of things that happen around us. And really, our control is very minimal. And a lot of bad things happen to people we love that there's really no way that we could have made it any different, but nevertheless, we feel guilty anyway, even though it may not seem reasonable or logical to people to feel guilty, they still feel guilty in their gut. But I think people do that. People use guilt much like they use anger, and it all has to do with the what ifs. And when it comes to guilt, it's what if I had done something more? What if, what if, what if? Well, you know, people, I don't think, can see into the future, and it's hard to predict when, you know, things are going to happen like that. But we blame ourselves as if we can read the future.
You make the point in the middle of the book that you need to go through remorse and genuine remorse before you can have the kind of healing that you need.
Yes, yes. You really need remorse, or again, more specifically, sadness. If you come to a session looking for relief from guilt, but you really don't have any sadness, it's not going to work.
There was a really interesting case I wanted to make sure I remember to ask you about this, about a cardiac surgeon named Bob. And you title this, you really don't expect me to say that was actually my brother, do you? This guy illustrates how he was skeptical going in, then he has a pretty profound experience, and he still wants to be skeptical, right?
Yeah, and that's another case that illustrates that what you believe before the experience really doesn't matter. It also really doesn't matter what you believe after you've had an ADC, whether you think it's real or not, because it's going to heal you anyway. And this guy was referred from a grief group where he wasn't doing very good in his group, and he came to see me, and he had a nice ADC with his brother, and then he exclaims, you don't really expect me to believe that was my brother, blah, 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 and kind of left in a huff. But I got a call from his the therapist in the grief group, and he said he came back one day and said he doesn't have grief anymore, and he's doing much better, and he's going to stop attending the group. So he was healed, whether he liked it, he liked the idea of it or not.
So is it possible to resist being better? I guess, I mean, even if you don't want to believe it,
the only way to resist is not to go through the procedure. But if a person is able and willing to go through the procedure and address the sadness and process it, an ADC is about 75% likely to happen whether you believe in this stuff or not. And you're going to get healed whether you believe in it or not. It really doesn't matter.
Have you done it yourself, or have you tried to do it yourself, or to anybody in your family?
I did the procedure on myself once, and I had a colleague do it on me once.
Can you share anything with that, or is that too?
Well, I'd kind of rather not.
Okay.
That's okay.
Can you say it worked or not?
Yeah, it did. And the two I had were very different and completely unexpected. I didn't expect either one to go the way it did.
Has anybody asked you about that before?
Asked me that question?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Where does the research go from here? What can you do to make the case stronger and to get more of your colleagues involved in it? Or is there...
Okay. You know, some people ask me, why is this not at every VA hospital in the United States? Why does not every hospice in the world use this? And the reason is these larger organizations are not going to jump on IADC until we have the research done. You know, they're not going to make it an official treatment at the VA just because somebody says it works great. We really have to have the research to support it. Now, what we really need, which is the gold standard in science, is a control group design study. And I'm happy to say that there are a couple control group design studies now in the planning stage that hopefully will get underway very soon.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. My whole goal is to mainstream this. As fringy as it may sound to some people, I would like to mainstream this, get the science behind it, and I don't think we should have any trouble doing that because the technique works so well and so reliably that I'm sure the research will support it. But, you know, we need to jump through those hoops, and we need to get that research done before, you know, large organizations like the VA hospital and so on will accept it as a standard treatment.
You know, I think it's worthwhile to go ahead and try to see if you can figure out why it works. But even if you never find out why it works, so what if it works?
Yeah, right, right. Why it works is certainly of interest. But before we can get that figured out, we have to show that indeed it does work.
Is there risk? Is there a downside other than weeding out the people who shouldn't get it at all, or who are not appropriate for the treatment?
Yeah, there would be risk if I didn't screen people first. And there is a risk if a non-professional tries to use this, because things can happen in the course of therapy. You need to be able to recognize what that is and so on and so forth. But once a person is adequately screened, which only takes 10 minutes or so, it's an extremely safe procedure in the hands of somebody who's adequately trained.
Can anybody fake it? Can they fake it? Or I guess they could fake it.
I suppose it's possible, but I would suspect that if I were working with somebody who was faking it, I think I could tell.
Dr. Bodkin, I really appreciate you being here. I found it to be a very powerful and persuasive book, and I hope people will check it out. It's called Induced After-Death Communication, A Miraculous Therapy for Grief and Loss. And I hope some of your colleagues were listening and paying attention, and will check it out.
Thank you so much, George. I very much appreciate your help getting the word out.
Anytime. When you do those academic studies, any of that other stuff goes on, you can let us know about it. Come back and let us know.
I would love to. That would
all
be
right.
Great.
Thanks a lot. Good night. Nathan Staton, Tricia Pepe, Dan Galante there at Coast to Coast, and our webmaster, Tim Binall, also my producer, Chris Burrows. Thanks to all them. Thanks also to my earlier guest, Mary Joyce, and Dr. Alan Bodkin. I am at MUFON next week, which is why I'm here tonight, sort of out of my regular order. I'm at the MUFON Symposium in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. A lot of great speakers. If you're living in the Philadelphia area or anywhere on the East Coast, you might want to check it out. And I'll be back in two weeks. Good night, everyone.